From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. It was another night of protests in Charlotte, this one peaceful, following the shooting Tuesday of a black man by a police officer. Pressure is mounting, though, for police to release video of the shooting. But at a press conference today, Police Chief Kerr Putney said that although he wants to do that, more investigation has to first take place.
If I were putting it out on my time frame, you would not have a whole case, though. And we would damage the very trust we're trying to build.
Susan McCarter joins us now via Skype. She's a professor of social work at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Professor McCarter, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
So about this issue of trust in Charlotte right now, I mean, you've lived there for 17 years. What is it like in the community? How does it feel?
We're sad. We're angry. We're hurt. Every side, and there are so many sides of this issue, trying to stand in community and see one another's perspectives. But that's hard to do when you feel defensive or you feel scared or you don't understand the complexity and the issues at hand.
Well, I understand you have actually been out protesting this police shooting yourself. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, you see, I'd love to hear from you what people, you know, who are surrounding you when you've been out protesting are saying, because, of course, the television images only capture a protest from afar. You don't often hear exactly what the protesters themselves are saying about this moment. So what have you heard?
Well, Wednesday night, we were speaking at Nation Support Community Church, where the sentiment was, as I described, fearful and hurt. When we left that venue and a few of us headed downtown, those sentiments continued, and you felt them just amplified times 100, you know, exponentially, hopelessness and hurt for our city, which continues to struggle with issues of race and racism.
One common narrative that we've been hearing over the past several days is that Charlotte prides itself as being a diverse and prosperous southern city, and that what we're seeing this week isn't the Charlotte that we know. But a lot of people are saying, well, how well do you know Charlotte? I mean, so, right? I mean, so,
right.
So, I mean, tell me more about that. Like, give us a sense as to, is Charlotte, do you think it is segregated? Are there structural inequities that are evident in the city?
Absolutely. I think there are the same structural inequities that you see around our nation. Our schools are largely segregated. Our neighborhoods are largely segregated. You know, we're the gentrified South. We serve you sweet tea and lemonade on the front porch, and we don't like to talk about social justice. We don't like to talk about race and racism, and we certainly don't like to make white people feel uncomfortable.
So tell me more about that, because the way you were describing the mood and the emotion in Charlotte now, everyone is feeling deeply unhappy and uncomfortable.
That's true. There's been a lot of conversation around looting and the defacing of property and violent protests versus nonviolent protests. But you really feel the palpable frustration and anger.
Well, when we have conversations about structural inequities and racism in America, the question of economic opportunity also oftentimes comes in, because there is a line of thinking that says if the economic well-being of many of the people in these communities were better today, that there would be no cause for these protests. Does that have any ring of truth to you?
Well, I would answer that this way. When we talk about racism, we really should consider racism social and institutional power plus racial prejudice. It's a system of advantage and oppression based on race. So, I would hesitate to say that Keith Lamont Scott was shot because he's poor. I think he was shot partly because he's black.
Well, Susan McCarter is a professor of social work at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Professor McCarter, thank you so much.
I appreciate your time.
Well, in other news, Marriott International closed on its $13 billion deal today to buy Starwood Hotels, creating the world's largest hotel chain with around 1 million rooms in more than 100 countries. And it will mean a big family of brands, including Ritz-Carlton and Westin and Sheraton, coming together. Arne Sorensen is president and CEO of Marriott International. He joins us now from the W Hotel in Times Square, New York, which is now part of Marriott. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So there are 30 different brands coming together under this merger. Are you going to keep them all?
We're going to keep them all, yeah. From our point of view, while we wouldn't necessarily say from scratch we need 30, we're glad to have them. And it really allows us to give our customers just that much more choice.
But I have to imagine there are going to be a lot of intersections in this country and probably around the world where you've got a Westin and a Marriott and a Sheraton all in the same place. You don't think that that's going to be too much?
I don't think it will be too much, actually. The markets where we've had the highest distribution for decades, think about Washington, D.C., which is our home, where we've had over 100 hotels for a decade or more. Atlanta, we have over 125 hotels. Those are markets in which our hotels perform extremely well. And yes, you can see a few of our hotels from another one of them, but they're positioned differently, they're priced differently. And again, they give more choice, which is a good thing.
What about the issue, though, of competition? This is now going to be the world's largest hotel chain. When we saw consolidation in the airline industry, it certainly meant that prices went up and competition went down. Is the same now going to happen in the hotel industry?
No, I don't think so. I mean, our share of the market is highest in the United States when you look around the world. And it's in combination, it's only 15%, 1.5. And of those rooms, over half are operated by franchise partners of ours. They price the rooms themselves. We don't price them for them. No part of our pursuit of the acquisition of Starwood was about changing the relative power we had in pricing. Not at all. You know, really more about how do you create a loyalty program which is stronger and more connected with our customers, which will hopefully allow us to drive occupancy, but I don't think it will have any impact on rate whatsoever.
Well, speaking of the loyalty program, there are a lot of customers I know, especially Starwood customers, who are worried that their points are going to be devalued now.
Oh, from the moment we announced the deal, the SPG members have been chatting with each other and communicating with us and communicating with Starwood along those lines. What's going to happen with our points? Are we going to be okay? One of the most exciting things about today is from the moment we closed the transaction, we rolled out to SPG and Marriott Reward members the ability to link their accounts, to have their elite level matched in the entire portfolio, and to transfer points from one program to another so they could redeem anywhere.
Is your biggest competitor at this point something like Airbnb?
No, I don't think so. I think our biggest competitors are the traditional competitors. We compete in the hotel industry, which is filled with good brands and great companies, and we'll continue to compete against those. We'll obviously compete against Airbnb too, but we think if we can deliver location and service and product at rates that make sense, we'll compete very well.
Do you ever expect Marriott to get into peer-to-peer lodging?
I wouldn't think so. It's quite a different business. In fact, one of the things that I think is interesting is when a customer of Airbnb has a bad experience, they blame the host, not Airbnb. I think because Marriott stands for something in the customer's eyes, if you waved a wand and had us in exactly the same business, that bad experience would be attributed to us.
How do you see the U.S. economy right now?
Fairly anemic. Our business is performing the way we would expect it to perform when GDP has grown at about 1%. And if you look under the aggregate statistics, what we see is a consumer, in other words, for leisure traveler or vacation traveler, which is relatively stronger than the business traveler. Business travelers, because their companies are, you know, maybe not in a recession environment, it's not that bad, but the profit growth is not very robust. They're being more cautious about their spending. And what that translates for us is fairly modest growth, positive growth year over year, but fairly modest.
One more thing I want to ask you, Arnie Sorensen, and that is this week we saw the CEOs of Wells Fargo and Mylan get called before Congress to testify over things that a lot of people see as just outrageous. As a CEO of a big company, what did you think when you saw that?
Well, I've seen what's in the newspapers, obviously, but I have not followed it closely enough to have a specific point of view about either of those matters. But I think what it tells me is when you're running a business of this size, you're running a business in a fishbowl. And that is just one more reason why you've got to be making the right choices. And you've got to be praying that your teams around the world are also making the right choices.
That's Arnie Sorensen, president and CEO of Marriott International, which as of today now includes Starwood Hotels. Arnie Sorensen, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And all this week, we've been talking about climate change. We talked about the science with physicist Joe Rome.
The biggest changes are in the high latitudes, the Arctic. We have seen stunning warmth in the polar regions as expected, and that has led to rapid warming of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets.
We talked about the politics of climate change with Evan Lehman of Climate Wire.
If Trump wins, who knows? He said he would pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and he's called it a hoax. So who really knows what Trump holds?
We heard from four cities around the country about how they're adapting to the effects of climate change that are already here, including Miami Beach, Florida.
It would be great if the state and the federal government would, be part of the solution and with policies and with dollars coming in, but they're not. So the local governments are really fronting the whole issue.
Yesterday, we asked climate scientist Brenda Eckwurzel for practical advice about reducing our carbon footprints.
If you drive, and if you drive what an average American drives, which is about 10,000 miles a year, it's the single most effective step is to switch a car to get better fuel economy.
So in a few minutes, as we wrap up our series, we're going to talk about what climate change is doing to animals around the world. But right now, let's talk about its effect on human health. Joining us is Dr. Jonathan Patz, director of the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Dr. Patz, what are some of the conditions and diseases that we're already seeing that have to do with climate change?
Well, one of the reasons I've actually picked this for my lifetime study over the last 20 years is because I think that climate change poses about the largest health impact that there can be. When you think about the multiple pathways through which climate affects our health, from heat waves, ground-level air pollution, like ground-level smog pollution, which affects asthmatics, very temperature-sensitive, and then some of the more complicated infectious diseases, any disease carried by mosquitoes or ticks. These cold-blooded insects are very sensitive to just small changes in temperature and humidity. So a number of vector-borne diseases, malaria, dengue fever, we think even Zika virus because it's so closely related to dengue, and many other mosquito-borne diseases. And remember, climate change is not just warming. It's also extremes of the water cycle, more flooding and more drought. So big on our priority list is the effect on crops and nutrition. And there are studies that showing that we could double the number of people at risk of malnutrition by mid-century because of extreme temperatures. If you have the other extreme of the water cycle, which is flooding, lots of exposure to contaminated water. And there have been studies out of the World Health Organization showing that at least 250,000 people are being affected by current climate change, and that's a low estimate because that's just looking at a couple of diseases, malaria, malnutrition, and diarrheal disease.
And when it comes to something like Zika or malaria, are these diseases that would exist in a certain place, but because of climate change, they come to places that are more populated, or would they simply not be around if it weren't for climate change? Because obviously malaria has been around for a long time.
Right, right. Well, each one of these infectious diseases is very complicated, and I'll tell you right now, of course, climate's not everything, but a lot of these diseases require a certain minimum amount of temperature or they simply don't exist. Like malaria, if you don't have temperatures above, say, 20 degrees centigrade, you can't have the development of that parasite in the mosquito, it requires a certain amount of temperature. So even though these diseases are very complicated and there are many factors that go into them, if you don't have warm enough temperatures for these tropical diseases, you can't have the disease. To answer your question very quickly, we may be seeing diseases move up in geography, like up in altitude, or they could spread in their geographic distribution. But there could also be a lengthening of the transmission season. So it depends on where you're looking. And there are so many other factors involved as far as predicting if diseases will be moving in geography. So climate is just one of them. And certainly the tropical diseases are sensitive to climate.
We've talked about precipitation. Let's talk about drought. What are the concerns there when it comes to human health?
Well, the biggest concern with drought, of course, is food security, and especially places that are growing crops that are in a narrow envelope of temperature and humidity. If you go above that envelope in temperature, those crops are going to decline. And according to the UN, the models project many of the crops to be decreasing, especially in sensitive areas where you already have problems, like in Africa and Central America. So that is one concern with drought. I'll just point out that while it's very difficult to prove a link in civil wars and things like that, I'll just make a marker, an observation that just before the Syrian civil war, that region experienced the most severe drought in its instrumental record.
Is there any way that climate change could actually be good for public health?
Well, there are a few instances where, you know, there are winners and losers. And for example, in the former Soviet Union, increased seasons for crops could be one benefit. There are some diseases that it gets too hot, like Rocky Mountain spotted fever in the southeastern United States. The models show that maybe it gets too hot for that tick, and some diseases will decrease. But according to several series of the reports coming out of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I've been a part of that for about 15 years. You know, we look at all of these health issues, and on balance, the negative effects far outweigh the positive effects.
That's Dr. Jonathan Patz, the director of the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking with us about some of the public health effects of climate change. Dr. Patz, thank you so much.
Sure.
And of course, humans aren't the only ones sweating climate change. Global warming is wreaking havoc on ecosystems from the tropics to the poles. And for a look at how wildlife is coping, we're joined by Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us at Here and Now. Hi, Vicky.
Hey, Jeremy.
And I think the first animal many people think of as one of the ones that most affected by climate change is the polar bear. Is that accurate?
It is. Even serious scientists say the polar bear is the poster child for climate change. The bears make a living mostly by hunting seals out on the sea ice, and that ice is in trouble. There's less and less of it in summer, and summer conditions are lasting longer. So just last week, we learned from the National Snow and Ice Data Center that this summer was a bad one for melting ice in the Arctic. In fact, it was tied for second worst on record. And the center's director told the Associated Press that he wouldn't be surprised if Arctic summers were ice-free by the year 2030.
Wow, which is just 15 years from now. What happens to the polar bears if that happens?
All kinds of things could happen. On the optimistic side, maybe we'll see some polar bears, depending on the area, adjusting, eating other things like snow goose eggs and musk oxen where they can and where there may be alternatives, but it's not straightforward and we don't know what's going to happen. There could also be some surprising results. Have you heard of so-called growler bears or pizzlies?
No.
That's what you get when polar bears and grizzlies mate. Mm. And with climate change, they're coming into more contact. So far, we're just seeing a handful of cases.
So that's what's going on in the Arctic, which of course is not the only environment where animals are being affected by climate change. What are we seeing elsewhere that may not be be so immediately obvious?
So climate change, the melting ice, sea levels rising have global impact and affects everything from weather patterns to ocean temperatures that you've been talking about around the world. And for animals everywhere, things are changing. Cod, lobsters, starfish, bears, bugs, from the tiniest animals to the largest. To get our minds around the scope of it, I spoke with Carl Safina, the renowned conservationist. And chilling as it is, he gave an amazingly easy-to-understand picture of how climate change is moving animals around. Let's listen.
It's like the tropics are expanding north, and things that live in the tropics will be pushed toward the poles, and things that live at the poles will be pushed off the planet.
Pushed off the planet sounds pretty ominous. Are we already seeing that kind of movement in animals that he's talking about there?
So how about one kind of bird who's now nesting 1,000 miles north of where it ever had before? I just 2 days ago got a kind of stunned email from the Wildlife Conservation Society saying that Caspian terns have made this huge jump. And WCS says it's just one example. Fin and humpback whales are spending more time in the Arctic. Species like the red fox and brown bear are more routinely coming into contact with Arctic foxes and polar bears.
And what are the consequences of that?
It's just one of the many million-dollar questions scientists have. Red fox taking over Arctic fox turf or Caspian terns affecting local fish populations, we'll see.
Are there any animals doing better under these changing conditions?
Well, of course, mosquitoes come to mind. Hmm. But also Wildlife Conservation Society, Wildlife Society, is reporting that a new study indicates that the northward march of white-tailed deer into Canada's boreal forest is more about climate change than anything else. So white-tailed deer range is expanding and wild boars are gaining ground in Europe.
And, of course, not all animals can just relocate.
No, it's tough for lots of animals to move out of where they are. Habitats fragmented. Giant pandas depend on those bamboo forests. Elephant populations are being squeezed, so where can they go? And it's especially important now to expand programs that create those green corridors and passageways for wildlife. It's very much on the minds of managers of our national parks and every wildlife conservation group.
That's Vicky Croak, who hosts the Wildlife blog. We'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. And when you go there, you can also find all the rest of our stories from our week-long climate change series. Vicky, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
There's talk of impeachment against New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It comes after testimony in the so-called Bridgegate trial this week that some New Jersey lawmakers believe shows Christie knew about the scheme to cause a huge traffic jam on the George Washington Bridge 3 years ago this month. Two former Christie aides are accused of orchestrating the gridlock as retribution against the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, because he didn't endorse Christie's reelection bid. They pleaded not guilty. Christie is not charged and has denied knowing about the scheme. Joining us now is Joe Hernandez, South Jersey reporter for WHYY. And Joe, NBC4 New York first reported that some lawmakers in New Jersey are considering impeachment against Christie. How serious is that talk?
Right, Jeremy. So there have been murmurs of this, but this NBC story is really the first one to kind of drive home the point that lawmakers are thinking about this and actively considering it. Beforehand, many of the Democrats were only saying that they weren't ruling it out. No governor has been impeached in New Jersey before, so it's unclear what this would look like. But I should add that there was a legislative investigation into this Bridgegate scandal before the trial. Democrats put that on hold during the trial, but they said after this trial is resolved, they're going to pick it back up again. So that could reveal some more things.
Well, what testimony has the jury heard so far that might indicate that Christie knew about this scheme to cause gridlock on the bridge?
Well, so far, no witnesses have definitively said Christie knew about these lane closures. Prosecutors and defense attorneys have suggested as much, though, in their statements. In the opening statements, the government said that two of the men in the scheme bragged to the governor during a September 11th memorial ceremony in 2013. This is while the closures were still going on. One of those men is David Wildstein, who was a high-ranking official at the Port Authority, which controlled the bridge. He's pleaded guilty. He's expected to be the prosecution's star witness in this case. We're expecting to hear from him soon. We don't know exactly what he's going to say, but apparently he had a very close relationship with the governor. One of the defense attorneys described Christie as referring to Wildstein as his Mr. Wolf, which is a reference to Harvey Keitel's character in Pulp Fiction, who cleaned up the dead bodies. So that should be some interesting testimony.
The mayor of Fort Lee took the stand on Tuesday. What did he say?
Right. So this is Mayor Mark Sokolich of Fort Lee. He's the guy that Christie allies were reportedly targeting with the scheme. He said before the lane closures, Christie officials, including officials in the governor's office in Trenton, were courting him for an endorsement for Christie's reelection. Operatives knew that Christie was going to win reelection, but they really wanted to widen that margin, to drive home the point that Christie had bipartisan support. So they targeted Democrats for their endorsements. Sokolich said he was wooed with things like tours of Ground Zero, lunches with the governor at the governor's mansion and drum thwacket outside of Princeton, and even tickets to see the New York Giants play. Sokolich did not endorse, and then that's when these lane closures happened. He said it was absolute gridlock in Fort Lee, and when defense attorneys questioned why he said publicly that the lane closures weren't politically motivated, Sokolich said he was petrified of further retribution.
And just very briefly, how much is this hurting Christie in New Jersey?
In New Jersey, his poll numbers are at an all-time low. He's at about 23% approval ratings. He's also, as you know, working for Donald Trump as the chief
head of his
transition team. Right. Yeah. Christie said a couple weeks ago that the Bridgegate scandal probably played a role in his decision not to pick Christie for VP.
That's Joe Hernandez, South Jersey reporter for WHYY. Joe, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Colombia is known to many as the land of a thousand rhythms. Public radio contributor Beto Arcos has brought back some of the newer rhythms with him. He recently went to the annual Bogota Music Market, or BOM. He's also host of the podcast The Cosmic Barrio. Beto, welcome back.
Oh, pleasure to be with you today.
So how was the conference?
Jeez, incredible. I mean, every time, this is my third time in Colombia. Every time I go, I discover, I find new things. But this one was one notch higher than the previous trips because it's all focused on Colombian music. And there are a lot of styles and music and bands that came to this conference. And it was just, to say the least, exciting, very exciting.
Oh, I can hear the excitement in your voice. So let's listen to some of the music then. Let's start with Viejos Tiempos. This is by Nelda Piña y La Boa off their 2015 album Animal. So Beto, tell us a little bit about this track.
This is a great band based in Bogota, but the lead singer here is a woman who is actually from a region in the Caribbean side of Colombia. Her name is Nelda Piña, and she is known as a bullerengue singer. Bullerengue is one of the many styles from the Caribbean coast. In this case, as you can hear, it's a confluence of a singer from this traditional dance music from Colombia and Afrobeat. It's a beautiful. It could only happen in Colombia. An Afrobeat band of Colombians coming together to do this beautiful, beautiful mix of music. Oh, this is great.
Well, there's a very strong jazz influence in this track too. I mean, did you hear a lot of that when you were in Colombia?
I did, and one of the bands actually that played is actually a jazz band, but with a distinct Colombian sound, and it's the one that we I'd like to also share with you. It's called Curupira, from their new album recorded in New York, La Gaita Fantástica.
So Beto, this is lovely. I mean, obviously starting off there with that very traditional sounding flute, but then it takes kind of an upbeat turn.
Yeah, this is based on a musical style also from the Caribbean coast of Colombia called gaita. The gaita is also an instrument that looks like a long flute. And there's two flutes. The two gaitas are macho and hembra, or male and female. And they, of course, you know, have this kind of back and forth between them. And what you hear in this case is this band that is reimagining jazz with Colombian instruments, with a special sound from that style of music, gaita.
Well, let's slow things down a little bit here. I want to play a track that you've brought to us by singer-guitarist Maria Cristina Plata. The track is called Y Pienso en Ti.
Empiezas a caer y no le hagas daño, que es un extraño que quiero conocer. Y pienso en ti, quiero verte en la mañana, que anochezca y que no te vayas, que cuando sueñes siempre encuentres lo que falta, que el pensamiento me lleve hasta tu casa.
So tell us a little bit more about Maria Cristina Plata.
Of all the great singers that there are in Colombia, there's many of them, by the way, and a lot of them are women singers. There's this kind of effervescence. She really stands out. Her style, her beautiful kind of contralto there. She's got a couple of albums only. This is her solo debut album. She performed last year at the BOM and won an award from the National Radio of Colombia as the best showcase of the BOM. And, of course, she's from the northeast of Colombia, in a region that also has various musical styles.
Mm. This is so great because we're hearing so many of these different styles as you're talking about. Let's bring yet another one in here. This is a track from Los Rolling Ruanas.
Bombardeo informativo y sin sentido. Falso paraíso. Lo desconocido. Mis ancestros van sin agua que beber.
Oh, come on.
Busca el sendero hacia el origen.
Come on.
Olvida el tiempo y viaja como el viento.
So more of a rock influence there.
Absolutely. In fact, when I was there, they performed at the festival. They played a tune by none other than the Rolling Stones called Painted Black. You probably heard
yeah.
that before. And man, I said something like, Painted Black never sounded better. Because they're playing traditional instruments, this particular instrument that is from the region called Boyacá. And the sound of this particular instrument is what really makes it special, but also the musical style, which is called Carranga. Carranga is a musical style created by a man named Jorge Velosa. And these guys are essentially taking, you know, a cue from him, but saying, well, we love Carranga, but we want to sing it our way. After all, you know, they live in Bogota and they have this all of these influence of rock and roll and traditional music. So anyway, the Rolling Ruanas kind of hints toward the Rolling Stones.
Yep. I love it. A Spanish version of Painted Black. I thought I've heard of a French version ages ago, but I've got to, after we finish talking, listen to the Los Rolling Ruanas version as well. This is a final track that you brought to us. It's called Tia Tortuga O.
Tia Tortuga O.
Oh, I love this, Beto. Tell us about this song.
This, to me, was the revelation of the entire conference festival. the center of this act are five women singers who also play this percussion called guasa. They come from the Pacific coast of Colombia in an area known as Timbiquí. It's a large community, perhaps the largest community of Afro-Colombians in Colombia. And they play this ancient music that they've been playing since slavery. And it's the most uplifting, earthy sound that you'll ever hear. I went to their performance and I was in tears. I was blown away by the energy, by the excitement, by the passion. It's infectious music that you have to see it to be able to enjoy it.
Mm. Well, the sound of it is infectious as well, and I can't think of a better way to wrap up the segment. Beto Arcos is a frequent public radio contributor and host of the podcast The Cosmic Barrio. He brought us some music from the annual Bogota Music Market. Beto, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
When the National Museum of African American History and Culture opens to the public tomorrow in Washington, D.C., visitors will be able to view about 3,500 artifacts on display that trace the experience of Black America. From the dress seamstress Rosa Parks was sewing before she was arrested to rock and roller Chuck Berry's cherry red Cadillac convertible. They can also take a look at Harriet Tubman's shawl and hymnal. Tubman was a slave who escaped to freedom and helped others do the same through the Underground Railroad in the 1800s. Now, the Underground Railroad has been shrouded in mystery, but Martin DeCaro from Here and Now contributor WAMU took a myth-busting trip down a stretch of one route in Montgomery County, Maryland, and found that the truth is no longer hiding in the woods.
No matter how many times tourists ask him the question, Mark Thorne remains patient and polite.
They asked me, where are the tracks? Where are the tunnels?
And they're stunned to learn there was no subway in antebellum Maryland.
To see people go through the process of understanding that that was just a term that was used and not a literal sense of a track and trail.
Yeah, not a real railroad.
Not a real railroad.
With locomotives.
Correct. And to see that kind of, that aha moment amongst adults. Because I come from a children's museum experience. So when I see adults have that light go off as well. It amazes me.
Every time Thorne and his colleague, Cheryl Spicer, take another tour group around Woodlawn Manor Cultural Park in Sandy Spring, Maryland, they get to separate fact from fiction.
All Quakers are not abolitionists?
In fact, Dr. William Palmer, the Quaker who owned this plantation, owned slaves, 13 of them, and his complicated legacy stands in the form of a stone barn built in 1832. So as we stand here in this incredible barn for the early 19th century, mm-hmm. I'm wondering how this plantation in what was the South became a transit point for the Underground Railroad. Shall we hit the trail?
Absolutely.
All right, let's go.
These woods have stories to tell.
As we head out to retrace the steps of runaway slaves and the conductors who helped them reach freedom, Thorne explains why the Palmer Plantation is the center of what he calls a perfect storm.
Right across the river is Virginia, the most northern point of the Confederacy. Then you look to your east, you've got Baltimore, which had the largest population of free blacks in the country. You look to Washington, D.C., that had the largest slave markets. And 40 miles is Pennsylvania, the Mason-Dixon line. So this was the point of the perfect storm. And that's one of the reasons why we have this trail and this experience here.
The trail simulates what an escaping slave might encounter, hiding places in hollow trees or behind thorn bushes, streams and creeks to drink from, and stuff you don't want to step into.
We find a lot of manure on the trail from horses. What that means to us if we're escaping is slave catchers.
Not all the hiding places were on the ground.
Okay, people, look up. You've got shelter and you've got a hiding source. You can climb a tree.
One giant poplar wasn't for climbing. It was a landmark to signal which way to go.
This tree is shaped like what? How would you describe that tree? Now, don't use the alphabet because 9 times out of 10, many who are escaping are illiterate.
I was going to say a V, but to an illiterate slave, that would have been useless.
Letters are not going to mean anything. What other common types of objects would you find on a farm that are familiar to you that you could use?
Considering I've spent very little time on farms in my life, I'm going to have you just give me the answer. We'd be here
Mark,
all day.
No, give us one.
A pitchfork.
Uh-huh. A pitchfork. Ah, yep. Yes.
You've been baling hay using a pitchfork. That's something that you're familiar with.
Flights to freedom through forests in the dark of night are just part of the story, though. My guides say slaves were just as likely to hide in plain sight in daylight.
One of the examples we use is a story of a young girl who was disguised as a young boy in order to be rescued from enslavement in Rockville. The young girl's name was Ann Mariah Weems, and she was about 15. And the way that they got her out of Rockville was to disguise her as a young man. And so she made it successfully from Rockville up to Pennsylvania.
And for every Ann Mariah Weems, there are many others, runaways and the slaves and free blacks who assisted them, whose names are lost to history. But with the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, Spicer and Thorne are excited about reclaiming as much of that history as possible.
I see this museum as shining a beacon and highlighting the presence of the African-American story throughout the country. It is your focal point. You're going to go. You're going to get the broader story. And hopefully it's going to make people curious. It's going to make them interested. Well, wow, if they have a Harriet Tubman, what do they have in my area?
To me, it is a method or it's a vehicle to get my community more involved into museums. And I think once people go to a museum that's about their story, they will start using these resources for science, technology, art. I think that this is a great doorway to my community, using museums more.
And as for those tourists who ask Thorne to show them the old Underground Railroad tracks, the museum should clear that up too. For Here and Now, I'm Martin DeCaro.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.